The theater. The theater.
Bring out Louis.
Theater. Theater.
To be or not to be.
Theater. Theater.
Hey, crew.
Hello.
Hey, crew.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
Halloween.
The day that we're recording is Halloween.
It is all this Hallows
will come
Eve.
Out yeah. The next week, but that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have a party that we're going to after this.
Yes.
With friend of the pod, Pam. It's her party.
It's Pam Quinn's.
She knows how to throw a goddamn party. Quinn, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're all dressing up. CJ, what are you doing?
We just kind of agreed that I'm going to up it a little bit more. I'm a little snotty about putting on costume for one more day of the year. So yeah. I have a really cute sweater that's all black cats and pumpkins, and they're all pumpkin shaped and it's cute. And then I'm going to wear cat ears. So I'm going to be a cat dressed as a cat lady.
Gotcha. Okay. Bales.
Yeah, Scott, you referred to Halloween as a Muggle holiday, and I thought that was I hadn't heard that.
A Muggle holiday for me. Like,
yeah,
the years
it's for the non-theater folk more than it is for us.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I just spent
it's a theatrical holiday.
Years running around doing late night shows and hustling costumes every week, and you know, multiple times. It's like, and then trying to come up with something clever. It just kind of bores me. It's like, okay, how many Ken and Barbies are we gonna get?
Into a drinking game tonight.
I will give $10 if anybody comes as Oppenheimer tonight. I thought about it. I'm like, I could come as like a fat Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
But I was like, I didn't have everything. You need just
get someone else to be Oppenheimer, and you can be big boy or fat boy, whatever the name of the bomb was.
Matt Damon.
It was the first bomb that they dropped.
Matt Damon. That's no. Wasn't it called Fat Boy and Little Boy?
It was fat. I think it was Fat Man and Little Boy.
Fat Man and Little. Little boy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we could be Fat Man and Little Boy. I'll be Fat Man.
A shirt that just says bomb on it.
Yeah. What are you
with a Batman hat?
Yeah, right. A cowl.
A cowl. I'm going, I don't know. I think I'm going to wear also similarly to CJ. I think I'm going to go with a pumpkin, like a jack-o'-lantern shirt that I wore for a short film years ago.
Uh-huh.
That I have. And then like wolf ears.
Okay. Yeah.
Listen.
You know, I don't know. I thought about going like Big Bad Wolf and like wearing sunglasses with my wolf ears and like a leather jacket. And then I was like, sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah.
My best Halloween ever was when I was Serial Killers producer, the late night show at Fools. I went as Jeffrey Dahmer one year. I went as an actual serial killer.
That's awful.
Yeah. I make a good Jeffrey Dahmer.
When we were in college, there was a crew that went as Bind, Torture, and Kill.
Oh my
God. It was not. I mean, we're from Kansas, so there was that kind of like, it was a little like, I don't know, y'all. We're 20 minutes from where that first murder happened. Scott, what are you doing?
Yeah, what about you, Scott?
I am coming as Halloween.
The spirit of
the whole encompassing thing. Every aspect of my costume will be part of a bigger theme.
I made this joke before we recorded, so I don't expect a laugh, but maybe an audience member will laugh. You're coming as the store spirit Halloween.
Yes.
Okay.
Gotta laugh for me.
I painted my nails.
Oh yeah,
they look
great.
Good.
Well, they look.
Well, from on the Zoom, they look fantastic.
Halloween
they look
like wouldn't have perfectly manicured nails either.
Right.
That's right.
Exactly. Exactly.
So Halloween's been scratching at the door. You know what I mean? But yeah, we're it's a Muggle holiday a little bit. I like that. I'm gonna adopt that a little bit because it's so interesting. Oop. I'm going to sound better after I click this. Do I sound better? I bet I do.
You sound diff? Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. I had to turn on my original sound for musicians.
Yeah.
Inside baseball there for you, listeners. No, I'm going to adopt that because I don't love dressing up. I have to do it so much as an actor. we wear so many hats anyway. That's more metaphorical, but like we just we do so much. We're constantly having to pull costumes, constantly having to look a certain way for auditions.
Yeah.
Let me put on some ears and have a drink.
Yeah. Listen.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. I love you guys so much. Yeah. We're theater people, and we're here to do theater stuff because this is Theater, the theater podcast for theater nerds, made by three theater makers from the LA theater scene. I'm J. Bailey Burcham.
I'm CJ Merriman.
And I'm Scott Leggett.
That's right. And each week we get together to discuss and debate the definition of theater through various lenses. And this week is my pick, and I chose the incredible monologue film directed by Jonathan Demme to continue our Jonathan Demme miniseries, Swimming to Cambodia.
Yeah.
Now, by Spalding Gray. Now, we're going to talk deep into this. I have so much I want to say. I'm so glad y'all watched it. But I want to hear first some of your thoughts while I set down my headphones and go turn off this timer that I forgot to turn off. I'll be right back.
Leggett, you were familiar with both of these films before we came in, right?
Yeah. I saw Killing Fields, which came out a few years before Swimming to Cambodia.
Yeah, it's like 84 and 87, I think.
Yeah, you're right. And so I was probably a little too young to have seen The Killing Fields when I saw The Killing Fields.
Yeah.
and as we were talking off mic, it's a very hard film for me to watch. I've probably only seen it 3 times over the years, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
It's brutal. And with the catharsis, that ending with Imagine playing and,
oh my God, yeah.
And that performance by Hangus Noor and Sam Waterston.
I read it was his first time ever acting.
Yeah, yeah.
And he won for Best Supporting?
He won Supporting Actor, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But then I remember when Swimming to Cambodia came out, and I remember, I have weird memories, but I remember very clearly Siskel and Ebert doing their review of it and giving 2 thumbs up to it and talking about it.
Hmm.
And I didn't get to see it. It wasn't playing in theaters around me in Beaufunk, Florida. So I remember when it came out on video and just sort of being like, whoa, this, like in my whatever 13-year-old head, it shouldn't have worked. Hmm. Like filming a dude sitting behind a desk talking for an hour and 40 minutes or however long it was. I was like, oh, this will never work. This will have to be boring. You'll have to check out at some point. And I was amazed at doing this rewatch, how I was in it. He just draws you in, and it was really cool. What about you? Were you weren't familiar with Spalding Gray even at all?
No, right? I hadn't seen either of the movies, and then sat down and watched them both last night. Just so
60 more seconds. I love you guys so much.
Okay,
you're doing great, buddy. Do what you got to do.
You guys are incredible. Love
you too. Yeah, no, amazing. We're working it out. We're
love
working.
Our bodies. I love our faces. Okay.
Thanks. Oh. But should I maybe start out with, for people that don't know what Swimming to Cambodia, what The Killing Fields is about? Because I have a breakdown for both of these.
Well, then let's do the first one.
All right, here's The Killing Fields, y'all.
CJ's breakdown.
Biographical drama film about the Khmer Rouge regime in Cambodia, which is based on the experiences of 2 journalists, Cambodian Dith Prawn and American Sidney Schoenberg. Right. This is all kind of like after Vietnam or during Vietnam and then into Pol Pot's regime.
Right. Yeah. Cambodia, we're
which
like
I
talking
vaguely knew about because of Behind the Bastards, but not enough.
Yeah. This is sort of the, 74, 75. So America is technically out of Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
but then there's, it's the Golden Triangle, which was, it's still mired in enormous complexity, cultural, political, monetary craziness of Laos, Vietnam, and Cambodia. And of course, we were all up in all 3 of those countries' businesses and ways
had
we shouldn't have been.
Had no business to be.
At all. And so, yeah, and this was just a small story that didn't come out for quite some time. Now it wasn't until like 1979. It was like 3 or 4 years before they found each other again, because it's basically the story of of a journalist and his Cambodian
interpreter, right?
Photographer. He was a photographer.
Oh, he was a photographer. Okay. And, I knew he became a photographer for the New York Times later.
And how he got put into prison, and how the journalist, played by Sam Waterston, tries to find him over the years, and just all of the mess of it all, you know, the breaking down of the embassy. And
right. I never feel fully equipped to even watch stuff about this time and place in history, because I started watching the... Oh, who's the guy that does all the long docs that everyone loves?
Oh, Ken Burns.
Yeah. I started watching that and got like two episodes in. And like by the end of the first episode, he literally says at the end of it, Vietnam is really complicated. And by the time I got to the end of the second episode, I was like, I don't understand anything
that's going on right now. I think it's a really... a good indictment of colonization. When you look at Vietnam...
Yes, I do know that.
You know, starting in, what, the 1800s, you got Spain, and then you had France. France was all up in it for so long, and then that starts to collapse. You know, communism is spreading. You have the People's Revolution in China that... You know, also plays into it. There's just paranoia, the Red Scare and all right. that. And it all just, it's just a perfect example of don't fuck with other people's country, even if they're a small country, like leave it be. And
we still haven't learned that lesson.
No major, you know, country has. And so we're dealing with that. Bailey, we're talking the state of Vietnam and the war in Cambodia and how
we did
Laos
a breakdown of the killing fields also.
Oh, yeah. Great. You did
which I also have one for swimming to Cambodia when we're ready.
Yeah. So did you already say what your context is with these things?
Yes.
You'd already seen them? So for me, killing fields, I was shown in a humanities class in high school my senior year.
Oh, okay. That's a good idea.
We had to write a paper on the pathos and the, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I remember being sort of like, why have we not learned more about this for real?
Right.
Like the things that were going on here. Like we learned about Vietnam in like seventh grade or something.
And I don't know how we were just talking about how complicated and confusing it is.
So complicated.
As soon as you get into it.
Right. And I left class the day that the movie ended, because it took like, you know, three class periods or something.
Sure.
And I remember it ended and I walked out and I was a little like wide-eyed.
Sure. Yeah.
I was just like, whoa. Like it really hit me. And I remember the first day when he put it on being a little bit like, this movie's looks bad. Like it looks bad. It doesn't look like Apocalypse Now. It doesn't look like
these other
movies that I expect to look like. And I was sort of like, whatever. But something happens really early on. It's that bombing really early on where it happens right next to them.
Mm. Well, the Americans bombed too.
Right,
nobody knew. Yeah.
No, I'm talking when they're sitting at the beginning of the movie. They're sitting at the cafe, mm-hmm. and a bomb goes off right next to them, and it blows them both sort of off the table. And I was like, oh shit, what is? Wait, oh crap! And then that's when the movie started going for me, and now I can watch it, you know. And have, you know, and love it from the moment that it starts and appreciate every bit of it. But I walked out of that class and there was this teacher there named Bill Colbert. And he, I have mentioned him before. He's amazing. But he's since passed away and he was an incredible mentor of mine and teacher. And he was into hot rods and all this cool stuff. And he, said, you know, You look a little dazed. What's up? And I said, we just finished The Killing Fields. And he goes, oh, yeah, that'll hit you. And I was like, it did. And he goes, I'm going to bring you something tomorrow. And I said, okay, whatever, you know. Next day he came and he handed me a VHS tape of Swimming to Cambodia. And I said, you know, what is this? And he said, you still got a VHS player, VCR? I said, yeah. He said, all right, watch this tonight and we'll talk about it tomorrow at lunch. And I was just like, okay, what is this? You know, it looked boring as hell. The VHS, you know, covers it. The front, I guess, is cool, but it just says Swimming to Cambodia, and on the back, it's that image of him pointing at the map.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, it's a lecture? Boring.
Yeah.
But that night I was bored and I watched movies to go to bed and I did, you know, all this stuff. So I put it on and about 20 minutes in, because it does start off, you're kind of like, okay, a guy's talking to me.
Mm-hmm.
But about 20 minutes in, something he said, I don't even remember now, even rewatching it, I was like, I don't remember what it would have won, like really hit me. And then I just was in for the rest of it and finished it. And the next day went and we had a whole discussion over lunch about it. And I was just obsessed. And I've always held on to it as like, you know, it's theater. It was a show that he built and we'll talk more about it, but it's theater that informs and makes a film better, yeah, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And without even really being about the film, like it kind of is, but also kind of isn't.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But then now as an adult and as an artist rewatching it, it hit me in 1,000 different ways.
Yeah.
This guy who had kind of quit acting and, you know, all of a sudden was doing this huge role in this thing he really cared about over in Thailand. And he's, you know, and all that. I love this movie. I'm really glad y'all let me pick it and that we got to cover it. So thank you.
Yeah.
May I say one final thing about The Killing Fields?
Yeah.
It was such a pleasure to see young Sam Waterston.
Oh, man.
John Malkovich. Craig T. Nelson. Like, Sam Waterston to me has always been a little old man with a great head of hair and a bow tie. Like, that's sure. who he's always been to me. And he was just a young, handsome thing. It was a lot of fun seeing all those young guys in there.
Yeah. I kind of got a little fan theory about fan fiction-y about it, where I was like, and then this guy grows up to be the head of ACN on the newsroom.
Yes.
You know, like, I was just like, same person, you know, but like, obviously it's not, but yeah.
And Sam develops Waterston, a drinking problem.
Yes, exactly. Playing Sidney Schoenberg, who, you know, was a real person. Hang S. Noor, who played Dith Prawn. You know, two just impeccable performances.
And he won the Oscar. And then he was sadly murdered, Hang S.
No.
Oh, no, you're right. That's right.
Yeah.
Hang S. Noor.
He'd never done it before. He'd never acted.
Never acted before. But he was murdered in L.A. Yeah.
Yeah. So according to his bio, he was a native Cambodian who was a captive of the Khmer Rouge.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he was imprisoned and tortured. And in order to escape execution, he basically told them he wasn't a doctor, even though he was. And he said, I have no education. There's no need to kill me. And so they spared him. And then he moved to the U.S. as a refugee in 1980.
Wow.
Is this Dith Prawn or the actor?
This is the true person. This is Hang S. Noor. This is the actor.
So he is the exact same storyline as Dith Prawn, basically.
Basically.
Yeah, I mean, that's what he did to survive.
Right. So he was chosen to portray Dith Prawn because of his experience.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hey, man, we know that was one of the most painful experiences ever, but could we just poke that wound for this movie?
You're gonna be so good.
The final piece of that story, just because I think it is actually worth mentioning, is that he spent a lot of his time working with human rights organizations for Cambodia and beyond. And a lot of people, he was found shot dead in 1996, and a lot of people believe it has to do with his opposition to the Khmer Rouge.
Damn.
Like, it might have been a hit.
Fuck.
Which is pretty amazing.
I don't even think they've ever
solved that. No, I don't think so. But the fact that he was able to bring so much truth to the role is what, you know, really makes the movie. Obviously, Sam Waterston is incredible. The whole supporting cast really is just like at bat. Even Spalding Gray in his like couple of scenes where apparently he's hung over as shit. But yeah, so Killing Fields, I think everyone should check out. It's a 1984. It's a British funded film, Roland Joffe, who gets a few shout out stories in Swimming to Cambodia, which we'll talk about. But anything else you guys want to say about Killing Fields? Because I think
But I'm glad I watched it.
And that final moment, the most final moment. Yeah.
Cheers.
Everyone should watch The Killing Fields if you haven't seen it.
Yes. Yeah.
Very, very good. But then We have Swimming to Cambodia, which is a monologue that ran off Broadway, basically, for a really long time.
Yeah.
I think it was like a couple years, actually. And he was just perfecting it. He was just, he would do it different almost every night, check what was working, what wasn't working. And it was like,
he had his notebook on stage the whole time.
He always had that same notebook and that like weird McDonald's notebook.
Yeah.
And he, I think it was like a 4-hour show.
Correct.
That's what I read. Yeah.
He used to do it in two nights. You saw part one and part two, and then he honed it down and then honed it down again. Cause it's, the film is less than, like
it was
90
minutes.
It's almost, I mean, if you take out all the fat, it's 80 minutes.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, if you take out his walk in at the beginning and a couple other like Killing Fields montages, like that's a tight 80. I mean, you know, I mean, it doesn't feel like it when it's a monologue, but it goes quick. When you're watching it
goes so fast. Like it's so, he's so engaging. He's so interesting a person that it holds, you know. It was like I was telling CJ when you were off doing whatever weird thing you were doing, Bailey. But
beating up some people.
All right,
getting in a fight.
But just how utterly compelling it is from the onset, which is. You know, he was a really interesting dude who, you know, this is what he did. Like, this is what he became famous for. CJ was like, I don't know what else he did. And I was like, he didn't do a lot. He did several of those little roles in bigger films he shows up in.
Sure.
But he was sort of just part of New York intelligentsia and wrote for The New Yorker and, you know, did these monologue plays. I did love that it's in a small theater.
Mm.
We're clearly in a very small,
uncomfortable looking chairs from how people were bunched in there.
But it gets that energy because, you know, that's so immediate and so close and so intimate.
May I just say, the couple times that I glanced at his picture or saw screenshots of this, I kept seeing Justin Kirk. Justin Kirk, I know him as Uncle Andy from Weeds, but he's in Succession. And
he's Pryor in Angels in America.
I thought of a friend of the pod, Mars Richards, a lot. He's got sort of this sort of loud quality to him that. Where you instantly sort of know this person's smarter than me and they're going to talk to me about things that I don't fully understand, but is still, you know, absolutely riveting.
Well, and I wanted to discuss the style. Like, well, I mean, obviously it was a one-man show. It was a monologue. But there was something to me that was very almost spoken wordy about it a little bit, because that's how I feel he kind of kept you engaged, because he had a rhythm going and he had things that made it go. It wasn't just him standing up there talking to people. There was something melodic and rhythmic about it as well.
And apparently, I mean, I think a lot of that is because he had done it so much that he had built that.
Sure.
Right. But I think apparently early on, like, people were engaged right away. So he just, I think,
I mean,
he just
tells
had
a good story.
Song-y. Yeah.
He spins a good yarn.
He spins a good yarn.
He sure does.
He does.
Yeah.
Well, and I actually don't have a lot of notes on this because I just sat and watched it the whole time and enjoyed it and was jealous of it. Like, I want to do something like this.
Yeah.
But the thing that hit me the most. Was that this is a historical event and an event and a place that I don't know a whole lot about, but I feel that, and I'm sure it was just watching the two films back to back, but I feel like I learned a lot listening to him. The complications of everything that was going on then, the way he told it made me understand it a little bit better.
Yeah.
And it made me wish that there was somebody or a group of people that would do this with every massive world event.
Well, I just read a quote recently that said that the true test of intelligence is being able to explain a complicated situation simply, to be able to boil it down. And that's what he did. Like, he didn't cover every bit, obviously, of that part of history, but you knew exactly what was going on and what he was referencing, and he was very clear about it, literally just pulling down a map and going, we were here, and this is this, and this is this, and this is what's going on.
Even that moment, to go back to me sort of not, like, we learned about it in seventh grade and then really no other time. Yeah. That sequence, when he's showing you, like, how the Khmer Rouge even was found by the Vietnamese and, like, how it, like, all happened in that, I was like, wait, I didn't know any of that shit.
Yeah.
I didn't know any of that, of how it, how the, where everybody was lined up on the border, or all the, Vietnamese stations on the border.
Yeah.
And then that's where the menu, quote unquote, where they're bombing everything. I didn't know about any of that. I didn't know about this Khmer Rouge being sort of this like redneck faction of people that were found and built into the army that they were and weren't actually that dangerous until we got there.
right.
Like, I mean, it's just, oh man, I just didn't know. I didn't know a lot of this. Yeah. And it made me want to learn even more. It made me start looking up more shit about, because we don't talk about Cambodia a lot when we talk about the Vietnam War. I mean, we, people do. I'm just saying, like, in basic conversation, that's not the piece we're all talking about usually. And that is like sort of, it's a massive chunk of the puzzle.
Yeah.
Well, and Apocalypse Now only sort of gets into it with the, like, you can't be on the side of the river, you can't be on
that side. I feel like I learned more about Cambodia when I started learning more about Henry Kissinger. Like, it didn't even connect to me that it was actually, like, a big part of Vietnam or anything. But, yeah.
I saw this documentary years ago called Holiday in Cambodia, I think it was called. Or something like that. It was based on, you know, Holiday in Cambodia. It was that thing.
Dead Kennedys. But
the Kennedys, yeah. But it, Dead Kennedys. But it was it was about, like, the dance, like, the music revolution that was going on at the time.
Mm.
Oh, wow.
And I thought it was going to be really interesting and talk about, like, how the war was affecting, and it just wasn't. It was just this really boring thing about, like, the youth of Cambodia. And I'm sure some, like, a lot of people got a lot out of it, but I, like, went to the Limley, like, so excited to see it. And I walked out, like, I don't know that I know anything else about what was going on at that time. And I just don't think that was the point of the documentary. Anyway. But so all this to say, I don't know a lot about these things. And so his monologue, although it's not really about teaching us anything, really, does give me more info than you would expect to get from something like this. That's all.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel like a lecture.
Right. And he does a great job of balancing the macro and the micro. Like, in order to tell his personal stories, these little, and some of them just anecdotes, some of them just kind of weird, fun stories. Yeah. He's got to put you in the right place in the right time and reference what's going on well. And that made it more intimate as you went along. And as you, because some of the story with the guy, the Navy guy on the train.
With the small ears and the red face.
The small ears. Yeah. Like, first of all, great shooting, Jonathan Demme. Way to simply convey that thing, just setting up two cameras on either side and having the actor go back and forth and back and forth. And he doesn't do, like, you know, he adjusts his voice a little, but he's not playing a character. He's just going back and forth. And it's magical and hilarious and fucking weird. And you're like, oh, my God. What is it? Blue Flake Cocaine?
Yes.
Blue Flake Cocaine.
Which I have never heard of.
No, I don't know if it was just an 80s thing or not, but it was hilarious. Yeah. I loved it.
Yeah, that's a really solid part. When they show it on TV, I remember it popping up on TV one time on, like, A&E.
Yeah. Okay.
And there was they cut out all of the sex worker stuff. The woman performing the tricks with her vagina.
Yeah. Yes.
They cut out all that stuff, which is what I thought was always funny. But that the bit that lands for me so hard in that is about 10 minutes before that, he goes, everything I'm telling you is true, except for the bananas banana. The wall. That's not true. Yeah. And you're sitting there like, what is he talking about? And then like 10, 15 minutes later, he's telling this really crass story about, you know, and you're kind of like, okay, all right, yeah, she shoots stuff out of her vagina, okay. And then he brings up the banana, and you're like, oh, no. It sticks to the wall, and you're like, oh, okay, so am I meant to believe that whole story is not true, that he didn't witness any of that? Or am I meant to believe that just it sticking is not true? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's funny. That's a funny bit.
There was a tiny part of me that wished he would have had a conversation or something with one of those women and had like a personal story about one of them. But I was
kind
like, okay.
Like with the Navy guy.
Yeah. I was like, well, this is just supposed to be like, you guys wouldn't believe what goes on over there.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, again, it's the 80s.
Sure.
And, you know, he's talking about it in a way we probably wouldn't talk about it today. Right.
Sure.
But I think it's also his one time in the show to get a little crass and get a little like,
it's crass.
Yeah. It's real crass.
To my mom.
It is crass.
Scott, you brought up Jonathan Demme's shooting.
Yeah.
We've covered Jonathan Demme on this podcast because we did Stop Making Sense. I think they look very similar, actually.
I'd agree with you.
Yeah.
Which I love.
There's something about the lighting.
He frames him similarly to David Byrne.
Yes, absolutely. The lighting, I found. The placement of cameras for the cuts.
Mm-hmm.
I love those side shots.
Those are always cool. From
Scorsese almost,
like, it feels like you're backstage. Like,
Yeah.
Scorsese does that really well with The Last Waltz, which is maybe one we should put on the list because it's very theatrical.
Sure.
But he, you know, where you're in it, you're part of it, and then you're out and you're not.
Yeah.
And so that's interesting. But even like he's got the overhead camera for the one shot where he looks up to the sky and he looks right into the camera. And I'm like, that's fucking hot. I hope
it
was set up.
I think he uses that a few times because there's that opening shot and then the closing shot.
Yeah, you're right.
I love that shit. One of my favorite looks in the whole thing is whenever it looks like the fan is above him, like the black shadow passing in front of his face.
Was that like the helicopter bit or something?
It's both.
Yeah,
it's both. Yeah. It's a
Which
simple
is
thing.
Actually, an Apocalypse Now reference, technically.
Yeah.
Because he lays in bed and watches the ceiling fan and thinks of
with
choppers,
the door with
you know?
The doors
oh, right.
playing.
With the doors playing. Yeah.
Something that struck me with this that always, like, when I was a kid. In junior high and high school, I mean, I had the same teacher for 7 years in junior high, high school, Mark Sager. He was a terrible fucking teacher. I don't care if he knows.
Tell him.
I thought he's dead, I think. I thought
Ooh.
I hated.
He's really
I hope he's not teaching history in heaven
oh,
because
my Lord.
He was the one that tried to convince the class that FDR cheated on his wife a bunch because she wasn't that pretty.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's the teacher I had. But for years, I was convinced that I hated history and I just thought it was boring. And then I went to college and took like a full year or 2 years of theater history and fucking loved it. And it turns out that when you have a good teacher, anything can be really interesting to learn. And that's, I mean, this is going back to what I was saying about, like, could we have a show for every weird historical event in the world? Because, I mean, like, you're going to see a fucking off-Broadway show and then you walk out having, like, learned something that actually happened that you didn't know about before. And it just,
Like Hamilton. I'm joking. I want to bring up John Bailey, the cinematographer, a massive cinematographer, because it looks real good for 80 whatever, for it being in a black box, you know, with maybe like 10, probably less, probably like two lights that are non-theatrical lights. Like he's not doing a whole lot, and they make it look fucking good. Let me tell you some movies that this guy has been a cinematographer of. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to read them all, but there's a billion. Okay, the 1972 Premonition, Alan Rudolph, Boulevard Nights, American Gigolo, Ordinary People,
wow,
a massive, the Robert Redford directed, Cat People, Without a Trace, The Big Chill, which we have covered on this podcast,
yes,
Silverado, The Walter Hill Crossroads.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah.
Here's this Gene Sachs's Brighton Beach Memoirs. Neil Simon play. I've never heard of this. Tough Guys Don't Dance by Norman.
Tough
Mary.
Guys Don't Dance.
I've never
was,
seen that movie.
Oh, it was a disaster. But it's worth seeing.
He did the Ken Kwapis movie Vibes. He did Accidental Tourist, which I love.
Accidental Tourist is so good.
The
That's
sequel
also...
to Goodfellas that no one ever talks about, even though it came out before it, technically, right? My Blue Heaven.
My Blue Heaven.
When did Goodfellas come out? In the 90s?
Early 90s, yeah.
Yeah, because My Blue Heaven is like a sequel to Goodfellas, but it came out in 1999.
Right.
Right? Am I thinking of the right thing? That's the one with Rick Moranis and Steve Martin?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, he shot Groundhog Day.
All right.
Wow.
He shot As Good As It Gets, the James L. Okay. Brooks film, which I
love. Oh, my God.
He shot, I mean, I'm skipping tons of movies. He shot The Out-of-Towners. He shot For the Love of the Game, the Sam Raimi baseball movie, which I kind of stan. He shot the documentary picture, The Kid Stays in the Picture, which I love. He shot Divine Secrets of the Ya-Ya Sisterhood, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, Must Love Dogs, The Producers.
What?
And then a strangely bunch of enough, Good Burger.
And Good Burger. Yeah, right. You're right. That'd be cool. No, and his most recent stuff is like How to Be a Latin Lover, which did pretty well, and like, you know, some TV movies. And I guess he did a Greg Kinnear directed film called Phil.
Mm.
Okay.
And then a Steve Clark directed film called An Actor Prepares, starring Ben Schwartz.
You don't see. Oh. I had to read that Stanislavski book. That's Stanislavski, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, he also did The Kid Stays in the Picture, which is a fantastic.
Yeah, I said that one.
Did you?
Okay. Picture rules.
My bad.
Fight.
My bad.
Fight.
Fight. Kiss fight.
All right. Kiss
fight. Timer's going off again for some reason. One sec.
God.
But yeah, I think that one of the things that stood out as well when I talked about the macro and the micro was all those personal stories. The stories about the sex workers were funny, but his South African buddy.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Spalding.
And I kept thinking like, is that a South African accent?
It's not a great one, but by any stretch, but it's just enough of a hint that it makes it a character. You know, he got Spalding. Come smoke this. I'm doing Australian now. just smoke this Thai stick with me, like
a Thai stick for weed.
Yeah,
I loved his story about what taking one puff of weed and then being so high he didn't know where he was. Because I can relate. I have been there.
Oh yeah,
and sometimes it brings me to 2 a.m. sitting across the table from the Dean of Fine Arts at a Cracker Barrel.
Just paranoid as shit.
Oh my God.
We're just talking about the South African crew guy that's his buddy throughout the thing.
Yeah.
And like, he just paints the perfect picture. You know exactly who this dude is.
Yeah.
He's a crew guy, but then he throws his camera stuff in the back when he's wrapped a thing. And then he goes off into the jungle of wherever he's at and has crazy fucking adventures, and he's a scuba diver.
It's really funny to hear also Spalding, who is born and raised in Boston but has lived in New York a lot of his life, do a South African accent.
We were just discussing that.
Fucking bad.
Like, it's bad, but it's just enough flavor on it. Like, yeah. It's the Spalding.
Yeah.
So well that you're like, really that guy's back now.
I really love all the bit in the ocean with the swimming and the, you know,
oh
the,
my
that
God.
Stuff's all
and
really
apparently
great.
That beach is supposed to be like jaw-dropping, like,
yeah.
Because you do kind of walk through forest jungle and then it opens up on basically untouched, you know.
I've had a lot of people tell me Thailand is like the ultimate beach trip.
Yeah, it's
like,
well,
your
the whole country is just sort of
like Phuket specifically.
Yeah, it still stands out to me. That and Taiwan are two places I got to visit where I was like, oh, what? This isn't like anywhere else. It's not like Japan. It's not like Korea.
Sure.
It's certainly not like China. But the people are just lovely, and you know. Again, another example of, you know, colonization, just fucking with people, with the culture.
Fucking shit up.
He even talked about that little bit where he's like, apparently Cambodia was Shangri-La before colonialism.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It was absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
And, you know, he said there are places that are still that way, but it just got so ruined, and that 90% of the land used to be owned by the people.
Yeah.
And then it obviously fell off.
I would highly recommend Anthony Bourdain did Vietnam and Cambodia's two
That's
different
right.
episodes
mm-hmm.
and how Vietnam has come back and has become this sort of jewel of of tourism culture and culture, yeah. And they took their shit over and fixed a lot of stuff after
all my favorite restaurants in America are Vietnamese, straight up. My favorite restaurant in Wichita is Vietnamese. I went and ate there while I was there.
Yeah,
my favorite restaurant out here is Vietnamese.
Is it what Blossom? Is it?
No, it's Saigon Banh Mi and pho.
Ooh.
All right.
The shit.
If you're ever by there's like two Blossoms. There used to be three, but it's delicious.
There was a place called. What
it's called? It's called Blossom. Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Blossom's good. There used to be Sawgrass over in Silver Lake. I don't know if it's still there or not. But
this is
it
your
was
LA Eats. Oh my god. Yeah,
right. Digressions.
Listen, it's what I love about LA, though. Like you get, and I'm sure a Vietnamese person would tell you, like, oh, this isn't the same. But like, that's what I love about this city. It's like, what do you want?
But it
somewhere.
But it is like, I mean, Thai food in LA.
Great
Thai
food.
That's really gastro
diplomacy. Thailand planned that shit.
Sure, oh, you're right. Sure. You're right. There's a whole story of all that.
That's true. But it's hey, we're reaping all the best.
Yeah. Listen, oh my God.
Listen, the best.
I've tried Penang at like 13 different restaurants in LA and I've never been let down. It's so good.
Oh God.
And you know what? Hot take. I like the pizza in LA. Everyone can back the fuck off of LA.
You just have to find it.
Where?
Lots of different places.
Pizza anywhere,
DeSano's is my favorite.
DeSano's,
and it's
is
like
great.
Neapolitan Sicilian style pizza. Sure.
Lucifer's is good pizza, but see, I'm the guy, and I'll throw this grenade out into the world. I don't know if there is a more overrated cuisine than New York pizza, quote unquote New York pizza. There's amazing
New
York
pizza. We also
have
better theater.
Well,
no,
well,
but
we have different. We have
inherently enough. I would argue a more overrated thing might be Chicago deep dish pizza, because that's just water and cheese, and it's not that good.
Hard disagree. Hard disagree.
I think I've had one deep dish where I was like, oh, I get it now. But almost everyone I've ever had, which were in Chicago, I was just like, isn't it?
All right, all right.
I don't know.
Well, we should go to whatchamacallit here in out in. Oh, I'll figure it
pizza
out.
Pizza crawl, I'm in. Let's do it.
Pizza crawl.
Let's go.
Cut to two places in, and we're all like, oh, God.
I need a nap.
I need a nap and a salad.
Yeah.
And a fight and a glass of Metamucil.
Yes.
I saw a video once of Italian people eating Chicago deep dish. And that was a pretty funny video.
Oh, yeah.
Like, what the fuck? Is this a cheese stew? What am I eating? No, it tastes great. I as a concept, I'd rather just have a slice of fucking pizza.
Yeah.
But I get it. Okay, the other thing I wanted to bring up is we have built our podcast, like our first three seasons were kind of built off of the podcast Blank Check with Griffin and David, which is they cover directors' filmographies. And we were like, well, we could do the same thing, but with playwrights. And we did that for a few seasons. Now we don't do that so much. We do sometimes, but
we can always go back.
That's right. They covered Jonathan Demme's entire filmography, and they did
so
a bonus
great.
Patreon episode. I don't think they did an actual episode. I think it's a – I could be wrong.
Behind a paywall.
Remember. It might be behind a paywall. It might not be. If it is behind the paywall, it's $5 a month, which seems ridiculous, but like
– if you love the show, it's worth it.
Yeah, it's totally worth it.
I pay for a couple podcasts.
They do the whole Marvel Cinematic Universe, and they do all the Star Wars
movies.
And all
fun.
The Indiana Jones and all the Mission Impossibles and all – yeah, so they do franchises on their Patreon. But – they do like bonus episodes sometimes, and they did Swimming to Cambodia, and they had Griffin, one of the hosts, his dad produced it.
Holy shit.
Produced Swimming to Cambodia, is friends with Spalding Gray, was friends with Roland Joffe, was like a huge piece of this puzzle. So I just I'm not going to tell any of his stories. I thought about it and I was like, no. People just go listen to it. It is so fun. To listen to him just, and they don't even really talk. And these two guys can talk. They're like me.
Yeah.
They can just like go and go and go.
Mm-hmm.
And he just, for about an hour and a half, he just tells stories and like all these crazy things that you don't even know about Spalding and these things that add a lot of just salt and pepper to the stories that Spalding's already telling. Mm. And it's just really fun. I think everybody should check it out.
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to say, I have this book, and it's called The Film Explainer by Gert Hoffmann. And it's a German book, and it's, I'm writing a play out of it currently. Mm. That I would love to do at Fringe or have some, or like direct and have someone do at Fringe. And it's right now it's a one person show that is inspired by Swimming to Cambodia. But there's this old profession called film explainers. And it was mostly in Germany, but there was a little bit in America, not so much, mostly in Europe. When film was first starting, people didn't really understand it. And especially once it started becoming an art form, 30s, 40s, 50s, it starts getting a little bit more into, like, not just, like, a train coming at you in the theater, but, like, full storytelling. Buster Keaton, Lloyd,
yeah.
Sure.
These guys, Chaplin. So there was this profession for a while, especially in Europe, where people would show movies, and then they'd, like, pause and, like, talk to you about it and, like, explain the movie to you, basically. Like, so see how he's doing this. This is... you know, a theatrical device that he's turning into a cinematographical device, and he's, you know, whatever. But then they talk about the film as literature, they talk about it as technology, they talk about it as what's going on in politics today, they you know, all this kind of stuff, like a YouTuber would now.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Right? But this was something that, you know, people would come from, you know, from everywhere to see, or sometimes they would travel around to different places, but these really rich people would want to understand the newest film.
Thing, right? Yeah.
So they would all come together and sit in the room and get explained the film to them. Obviously, yeah. That profession died out, probably in the 50s and 60s. But there's this really amazing story about a film explainer who was having to explain German propaganda films, but did not agree with them.
Uh-huh.
And so was having to, like, you know, so was sort of underground doing a little bit of, like, and they're saying this, it's not real, but, you know, and like that kind of thing. So he got very political and politicized, and this book is absolutely incredible. But I want to write a one man show out of it. I don't think I'm the person to perform it, though.
You've mentioned this to me before, and it makes me horny as shit.
Right?
Yeah.
I think.
Listen, I will put on my chin beard, and be in this if you
but
want.
You know, you can't take a man's role.
It could even be a woman, and I also have the idea of expanding it into like a 3 or 4 person thing,
sure.
Just because I think it'd be interesting to have, you know, a person who asks questions or a person who is his assistant or his lover or his, you know, like, I want to see more than just a one time him sitting down like Spalding Gray and explaining something.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting if there's stuff surrounding it, but I don't know what that looks like yet. Nobody steal my idea.
copyright.
Yeah, I just did it.
Cut to,
I just registered it with the WGA, so fuck you,
back off.
Cut to Scott Leggett's Film Talkers.
Motherfucker.
Mother, you son of a bitch.
Win Fringe, and I have to fucking murder you.
You go to New York and then Edinburgh.
Yeah.
You get up get up for the award. You get to say two word acceptance speech when you win an award at Fringe, and mine would just be Bailey Burcham.
it would just be my idea.
you motherfucker.
Original concept,
and
you just
and the funny part is you did a 2-word speech, but the person presenting the award did a 10-minute
yeah,
speech.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that's real.
A little shade
at Los Angeles Fringe. No, we love you. Okay, is there anything else y'all want to say, y'all want to talk about, y'all want to get into?
It was such a pleasure. I was so glad to get both of these movies in last night. So thank you for suggesting.
That's a night. Watching them both.
Watching
it was my only night off this week, so I made something yummy, and I sat down in my PJs and got cozy.
Nice. I just couldn't bring myself to do both. I do need to rewatch The Killing Fields again. But yeah, thank you, Bailey. I think it's important to do a quick shout-out. You know, Spalding Gray did take his own life.
Right.
I think in 2006,
2005 or 6, I think. Yeah, sounds I was right. Surprised to see that.
And he was 62 years old,
which...
and I just, and his mother had also taken her own life when she was like 52. So I just want to say, you know, and you watch this movie and there's part of me that kind of looks for that, looks for that depression. And certainly you can see that there's some sort of a little bit of manic energy and a great intellect behind it. But
what is the final line of the piece? And suddenly I knew what killed Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
He basically says, like, and that was the moment I realized, like, I don't know if he's blatantly saying this, but it feels, because of where he heads in, you know, in the next 20 years after that, it feels a bit like him saying, like, and that was the first time I sort of understood, like, taking your own life.
Right. And by that point, he would have lost his mother. And
yeah,
but I do want to say, please, if you please seek help if you're having those feelings, and don't be afraid to reach out. And and I think that I'm saddened, because I think that in his later years, in his 60s and 70s, he could have given us so much more wisdom and insight and all that. So it was a sad loss.
And he had other plays. He had Stories Left to Tell, and a couple other things. And apparently in 2010, Steven Soderbergh made a documentary about Spalding Gray called Everything Is Going Fine.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good.
I've never seen it. I'd love to check it out. But the quote Soderbergh said was, he wanted Spalding to tell the story as if it was his last monologue, and I think he accomplished that. So it's just, sounds pretty great. Did you guys ever see the documentary Now? Episode of Swimming to Cambodia. It's Bill Hader as Spalding.
Bill Hader.
Fucking hilarious.
Brilliant. It might be one of my favorite Bill Hader things.
Maybe.
And that's a lot. Like, that's saying a lot. But he just nails the energy of him so well, and of the whole piece as well. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Is that it? Did we do it?
I've got a spotlight.
Swim to Cambodia?
We did.
Oh.
Okay. Let's spotlight some Los Angeles theater.
LA Spotlight.
This is the last time you're going to hear this from me, so you better get your fucking tickets.
Oh.
Dr. Dasha McGee, friend of the pod, Donkey, a cultural biography of a public school teacher, one night only, Wednesday the 8th. At 8 p.m., it's part of the Spaghetti Festival at the Elysian Theater, which the Elysian Theater is fucking awesome. I've driven by it several times, but have never been in it. It's a really cool space. ElysianTheater.com/spaghetti for tickets.
And I'll just do a quick shout out. Check out the Broadwater LA on Instagram and Facebook for a plethora of stuff. For those who don't know, and I know we've explained it many times, the Broadwater is a theater complex in Hollywood run by Sacred Fools. But the majority of the work that's happening is rentals, and just a crap ton of cool theater coming in. A production of Life Sucks just wrapped up. It was really, really good. But on any given night, you can find fantastic sketch, improv, there's readings, there's plays coming in. But if you follow the Broadwater LA or the Broadwater LA on Instagram and Facebook, you can check out everything that's going on a daily basis.
Yes.
I don't have any spotlights, but since we live in LA and we talk movies a lot, I just want to shout out the movies that I'm very excited to see for the rest of the year.
Oh,
I've already seen Killers and Killers of the Flower Moon and all that. I want to see The Killer by David Fincher.
Yes.
Okay.
I want to see Priscilla, Sofia Coppola, Priscilla Presley movie.
Okay.
Looks good. Poor Things.
Oh, yes. That's Emma Stone one, right?
Yeah. That might be my number one.
Yargos. Ooh, dude, yeah. I'm quite excited. There's also a Godzilla Minus One anime coming out. That sounds pretty good. Napoleon, the new Hunger Games, Saltburn, The Holdovers. Guys, The Color Purple. We're getting so much good shit.
When does The Color Purple come out?
December, like Christmas Day or some shit.
Mm.
Yeah. But I'm excited to see that one.
Yes. I'm excited to see some fucking movies this holiday season.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us for swimming to Cambodia. I super appreciate y'all letting me cover that. And then next week we begin our mini series with Roddy Viegas, who will be doing 2 weeks with him. We'll probably record them all in one day.
Yeah.
Just so you know. Inside baseball.
Yeah.
But we will be back after that with Shakespeare.
Unless I'm doing a pick, but I can save it for next year.
Oh, no. Then we have a CJ pick and then 3 episodes of Shakespeare.
Dust. And we also have a curtain call, so maybe we don't need to do
a pick. Oh, shit. And then
a
curtain call? No. Why? Don't. No, okay. Don't do that. Right. Don't do that.
Well, it can. Okay.
You don't Good. Do that.
Because we're doing Christmas shit for my pick.
Okay.
Yeah. You good?
Yeah.
Do y'all.
Yeah, CJ, you go ahead.
Do y'all have questions or comments? Please reach out to us via email, Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Scott?
Thank you so much, CJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson, who writes our theme song. Our theme song is, how do I say this? Better than your fucking theme song. That's
Witches?
All I know. He also writes all of our stingers. He's an amazing human being. And finally, to the great award-winning playwright, Carol Churchill, who writes every single one of our episodes and doesn't even know it. And one day, Carol Churchill, we're going to buy you a beer or some sort of cocktail.
True. A Manhattan? I don't know.
Yeah.
a rusty nail?
Huh?
Whatever she wants.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll see you guys later.
Mama.
Little boxes on the side. Little boxes made of ticky tacky. Little boxes made of stairs on the side. All the same. There's a green one and a
blue one and a yellow one and a meow
and a meow meow. And they all look just the same. That's from Weeds the Musical.
Later, everybody.
Peace.
The theater. The theater.
Hang out, Louie.
Theater. Theater.
To be or not to be.
Theater. Theater.